Welcome to the ETOP Podcast with your host, Richard Walsh. I'm a 30-year business-owning veteran, creator of the ETOP Academy, and best-selling author of Escape the Owner Prison, the contract's new way to scale, regain control, and fast-track growth while loving life. My mission? To help 10,000 business owners create the freedom in their lives to do what they want, when they want, and still be massively successful. Now, let's hit our topic for the day.
All right, here on the ETOP Podcast with my guest, Jeff McCausland. Jeff, this is going to be a great episode, so you guys just buckle up. It's going to be a great one. Jeff is of Diamond Six Leadership. He's a retired Army officer, West Point Gray, of course, and his resume is thick. Okay, I'm just going to say everything from CBS radio and TV as consultants and commentators on things to just, he's going to fill us in because, again, it'll waste up too much of my time when I got the man who knows himself better than anybody who's going to introduce it, bring us up to speed. So without further ado, Jeff, come on board. How are you doing today, buddy?
Richard, I'm doing well and a great pleasure to be with you. Yeah, quickly, my background, 30 years in the military, retired as a colonel of the United States Army, graduated from West Point, as you suggested, Richard. My final job in the Army was I was the Dean of Academics at the United States Army War College, where the Army developed strategic leaders for the military and all services, as well as senior government civilians. In the course of that career, spent a lot of time in Europe, about 12 years in Europe, worked on the National Security Council staff in the White House in the late 1990s during the Kosovo crisis, and commanded a battalion during the Gulf War back in 1990 and 91. In fact, Diamond Six, the name of my company, that does leadership workshops for corporate executives all around the country, comes from the fact that that was my radio call sign during the Gulf War. And I led 750 soldiers. We were part of the lead attack force by the 7th U.S. Corps into Iraq. And it was through outstanding leadership on the part of some fine young officers, sergeants, and soldiers that we got through that. We had several guys get wounded, but we didn't lose anybody. And that's a testimony to their leadership. And with that in mind, I wanted to call it Diamond Six. Since I retired about now almost 20 years ago, I do work as a national security consultant for CBS radio and TV. I'm also a visiting professor here at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I've served in other places such as at Penn State University teaching leadership, and also oddly enough for an old soldier at the United States Naval Academy. But from our time with Diamond Six, we began doing executive leadership workshops, began using Gettysburg as a case study, something we'd use for War College students. And the book, of course, is, as the title suggests, leadership lessons from that battle that we believe apply to leaders now in the 21st century. Because one of the things, Richard, and you and I have already agreed to this off mic, that good leadership is good leadership. It doesn't matter whether you're leading Hebrews out of Egypt as Moses, or you were a leader in colonial America, or during the Second World War, perhaps, or now a business leader coming out of a pandemic in the 21st century. Good leadership is good leadership, and the precepts and concepts are enduring. And secondly, I would add, and that's why a battle like this has, I think, some import, is if we all together had gone to look at a major organization and had access over a time, we could tell how well or how poorly it was being run if we could visit. But if we were there when the organization was in a crisis, well, good leadership and bad leadership, the climate, culture of the organization, good and bad, would stick out in bold relief. And that in many ways is what a battle is. Two organizations in a crisis, time is now compressed. Leaders have to make decisions, strategic, tactical, and operational, that are crucial on whether or not they're going to be successful.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, it's all obviously spot on. So let's begin it this way, okay? Because we're going to get into the, we're going to talk about Gettysburg. We're going to talk about the leadership on the battlefield. And I love the, you know, two teams, two groups in a crisis, okay? And that can be, you know, again, that transfers right over to the business world as well. But let's start with how you actually define leadership. I think that's important that we kind of get that base. So give us your definition of leadership.
Yeah, my definition of leadership, you know, if we were to Google the word leadership right now, if anybody was wanted to do what while they're listening, they would literally get hundreds of definitions, some long, some short. But over time in my study, I've come across a definition provided by Dwight Eisenhower that I kind of like and I use in all my seminars. And Eisenhower once said, leadership is the ability to decide what has to be done and then get people to want to do it. And I think that's a great definition for a number of reasons. First, it's brief. I can remember that. Second of all, it comes from a pretty doggone good leader. Obviously, Eisenhower had been a five-star general, led U.S. forces and Allied forces, oh, by the way, in the invasion of Normandy, and then the march into Germany during the Second World War. Will subsequently become president of the United States for two terms. And historians today, frankly, treat the Eisenhower presidency a lot more kindly, perhaps, than he was treated when he left office. And finally, he was a corporate leader, a leader in education, you might say, because from the time that he retired from the Army until he gets elected to be the president, he'll be the president of Columbia University in New York. So a very diverse and obviously fantastic leadership experience. And then the final thing I like about that definition is the second part, get people to want to do it. Because you might think, well, hell, you know, if I've been a five-star general and president of the United States, president of a major university, all I got to do is give orders and everybody's going to leap their feet and rush off as hard as they can run and do whatever I tell them to do. What Eisenhower is telling us very wisely, I think very wisely, is that to get an organization to maximum performance, I've got to spend some time trying to build a consensus. I got to figure out how much time I can allocate to do that, because let's be realistic, you're never going to get a large number of people to totally agree 100% on any particular course of action. That's why you're in charge. Leaders do one thing nobody else does, and that is they decide. But still, consensus and getting people to want to do it is important. Finally, I add one caveat to that, and that is that if you took that definition at face value, leadership is the ability to decide what has to be done and get people to want to do it. Well, then you might say, well, wait a second. That means that Pol Pot, Adolf Hitler, Osama bin Laden, Joseph Stalin, a bunch of other horrible people were in fact great leaders. Did they decide what had to be done from their very twisted minds? Yes, they did. Did they get people to want to do it? In some case, very enthusiastically. Sadly, that is true too. Would we all agree they were great leaders? Good God, I hope not. So the other ingredient I think is important that one has to put around that definition is ethics, character, and integrity. I think those are fundamental. And after the Gulf War was over, my commander, Norman Schwarzkopf, who I'd worked for in the Pentagon, gave a speech at West Point. And in the course of that speech, he said, for any leader anywhere, there are two fundamental things that are the absolute bedrock of leadership. And those are competence and character. Competence and character. If you have a leader who's incompetent, you might like him or her, but they're dangerous and you're not going to be very successful. So competence is certainly important. But if they're not a person of character, if you can't trust them, if you really think that they're more interested in themselves and what this organization means for them than they are for the overall success of the organization, well, you're probably not going to hang around and you're going to probably find some other place to go and work. And that you can never build absolute trust with anyone if they don't think you're a person of character, ethics, and integrity. And I would argue that trust ultimately is the glue that connects a leader to his or her organization.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that for sure, Jeff, because the trust aspect is going to build loyalty as well, right? And that's part of it. I love the competence and character. Okay, that's critical. The integrity aspect, the ethics. I mean, it really does. That boils it all down, because you have to have these things, because people aren't going to follow. Well, I mean, some people will follow the corrupt, right? And the unethical. I mean, there's those people that he just gave us a list of people who did that. But I think it is a critical element. And when we cross that over into business, you know, I think today it's more critical than ever that you're able to lead that way. I mean, that to me is how you create a sustainable company. You know, because that leadership is going to begin at the top. It's going to work its way all the way down. And if you're that person, ethics, you're competent, you've got the right character, you've got the integrity, you built in all of that, that is going to be, you know, that's the bar, right? You set it. And then, you know, the good leaders are obviously going to bring that down, right? All the way down to the, you know, we'll call it the lowest person. I like to say that, but you know, the newest person on the team, so to speak. So I love that, man. That's a great definition. And yeah, Eisenhower is, yeah, a guy to look up to. But let me ask you one question on that you mentioned. Here's another thing about leadership that I think a lot of people don't understand. And you mentioned it talking about Eisenhower, how I know when his presidency was over, he wasn't, you know, I mean, there's a lot of smack talking, right? put it lightly. But, you know, but a good leader, you know, understands what they're doing. And from that example, do you see this often that, you know, the kind of the cream rises to the top, but it takes a while. And they kind of see the wisdom of that leadership and decision-making principles, but it takes time. So the question being, Jeff, is during that decision-making process, where you may be the only person who sees, you know, the final outcome, and you have to stick to that, and then you're what we'll call it proven right later, right? Is that a commonality with a lot of leaders?
Absolutely. You know, when I lived and worked in Washington, I was in the Pentagon, and as I said, I was at the worked in the White House. And I can tell you there was a saying in Washington, and a saying very frequently in the White House, you know, if you want a friend, buy a dog. You know, if you want a friend, buy a dog. If you're a leader and you say, my ultimate objective is to be popular. I want to be popular. I want everybody to like me and love me. Well, I got a flash for you. You're not going to be very successful, because as Colin Powell used to say, not to use some little rough language here, there's no way you can be in charge without pissing somebody off. You're going to have to make some hard calls. And those hard calls, as you suggest, Richard, whether they were a good call or a bad call, we'll only know over time. So again, if your goal is popularity, buy a dog, because a dog will always love you, okay? And secondarily, you know, success for an organization, I believe, is sustained high-level performance over time. That is ultimately success. There are some leaders, and I could name a couple, who will just drive an organization into the ground. And I think that's one of our challenges today, as we see leaders in strategic positions staying in the position for shorter and shorter periods of time. So their drive is to get max performance over this next year to 18 months, because that's the only time I'm going to be around and I'm going to leave, you know, when in reality, I would argue success is how well the organization does the day after you leave. You know, we used to say one of the missions of a commander in combat was to make himself or herself irrelevant. Make myself irrelevant, because if I get taken out, the organization's got to continue. And that's to me is the measure of success. And that means I'm building teams, I'm creating a climate that's a positive climate, I'm altering the culture, I'm doing those things and making decisions that will not be perhaps judged successful or unsuccessful for some period of time into the future. You can run people to death for a year or so and maybe short-term success, but I think that's a recipe for disaster longer term.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I see it a lot with businesses I work with and stuff too, that, you know, you have to build for the future, you know, and that's what it's about. You can't, I mean, you could be a turnaround guy, right? You can come in right. And you can flip around and get it working right. And oh, I did it in 30 days. Well, can I check back in 2 years, 3 years and see, you know, see what that business is? It looks great on TV, but really what'd you do? You know, so I mean, did you build something that lasts? And that's not an easy chore in 30 days. You know, you can get things profitable and do that. Yes, we can do that. But when it comes down to true leadership, you know, because obviously there was an issue there. I had someone ask me yesterday, same thing about a leader. Well, he could be good if he just would get his stuff together. I go, well, then he can't be good. Okay. Because he's not doing anything about it. So he's not a leader. Okay. He's just in a position. You know, he's in a leadership position. Not a leader. So, you know, you can't, and you can train people. I get it. But here's my next question. Is there an inherent, like, you know, we do all the personality tests and all that stuff. And yeah, leadership's one of my strong ones and blah, blah, blah. But is that something, I know it all can be taught, skills can be taught, but is leadership, is there a personality aspect of that you see, again, commonalities on leaders?
Yeah, there are all kinds of diagnostics that you can look at. There are all kinds of different traits that people talk about for good leaders. But I think your point is the most well taken, is it can be a learned skill. You know, one of the ones that people look at a lot is a thing called the Myers-Briggs trait indicator, which looks at you across 8 different traits and puts them in pairs. Often people focus on, am I an introvert or an extrovert, for example, and Myers-Briggs does test that out. And I think sometimes that's misplaced, because they get hung up, you know, they get hung up on putting labels on things when it's really, you know, along a cursor, and we develop over time. So those diagnostics that talk about ourselves and give us a snapshot of ourselves. I just finished one for my team to work with them. That gave us a snapshot of the team, but I want that more for them to reflect on themselves and then think about how they want to develop themselves, because leadership's all about one, self-awareness, number one, and number two, your ability to continue to develop. I'm still a developing leader. I've been working on this since I headed off to West Point almost 50 years ago, and I'm still a work in progress. And that's the thing I think leaders need to understand. I need to keep learning every single day. You know, it's remarkable, back to the Civil War, back to the book Battle Tested. Abraham Lincoln comes to the White House. He has almost zero military experience. He'd been a captain in the Black Hawk War, never heard a round in a militia unit, never heard a round fired in anger, was almost court-martialed because the guys in his company broke into the colonel's wagon and drank all the colonel's whiskey. And suddenly now he's in command of the nation during its biggest war to that point, and one could argue the biggest war we've ever had. Lincoln carved out a lot of time in the White House to study strategy, military tactics, military organizations. He would have large numbers of books brought over from the Library of Congress for him to study, to develop his skills as a leader in an area that he knew he was lacking in. And that is, I think, the important thing is for leaders to continue to learn, to continue to think about where they are and where they're going. Finally, I'm a big fan of the work by Daniel Goleman from Yale University on emotional intelligence, which talks an awful lot about a leader's ability to be self-aware, a leader's ability to have empathy towards those who work for them. That doesn't mean they're easy on them, but they can understand where they're coming from, and their ability to control their own personal emotions, not allow their emotions, their passions, to triumph over their logic. And I think that's one area where, if I was going to be held down and say, what's the one area you would focus on, I would tell leaders to look at their emotional intelligence. There's diagnostics on that you can look at. And there is also, according to Goleman and his research, obviously an area that one can continue to develop. It's not like your IQ, which is kind of pretty well fixed by the time you get to be in your late 20s, early 30s, your ability to learn, not the knowledge you know, but your ability to learn. EQ and leadership principles and traits can be developed over time.
Yeah, that's, the emotional intelligence has been, I've just come across that in the last couple of years, you know, the actual definition. Okay, I'm sure it's always been there, but I agree with you, Jeff, that I would choose the same thing, like, because I know I need some work in that. Okay, so what comprises emotional intelligence is really, really powerful, especially from a leadership aspect. You know, I think it's good for anybody, but it's just a powerful tool that can be constantly developed. I like that point about it. You know, it's so great when you're actually not done learning. You know, like, okay, I read that book, I'm done, I got to move on to the next subject. It's something, as we work on ourselves, that you can constantly hone and get better. And it gives you some hope, actually. You know, I can become a better leader over time. Just like you said, 50 years you've been working at this stuff. Now you teach others and everything else, but you have to continue to work on yourself. You know, I love that. So let me ask you, we were talking about Lincoln, which I love. Let's get into this Gettysburg aspect. I want to talk about the two leaders. Okay, and why it's so great for leadership. Okay, when you use it as a comparison, because this is going to be fascinating, and I really kind of want to get into this, if that's okay.
Sure. I mean, if you talk about the two leaders in the battle, of course, we're talking about George Gordon Meade on the Union side and Robert E. Lee on the Confederate side. At the ultimate level, and we can move there if you like, we're talking about Abraham Lincoln and his counterpart, which would be Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy. But as far as the battle goes, it's really fascinating. And this is one thing I like about this case study of Gettysburg, is these two leaders, Lee and Meade, are at very different positions in their organization. Robert E. Lee is older by age, had been a bit of an icon in the Federal Army before the war due to his exploits, had been superintendent at West Point, highly decorated for his service during the Mexican War. And by the time we get to the summer of 1863, he's been in command for 16 months. And he's been very, very successful. He's won all the battles that he's been involved with the exception of the Battle of Antietam, which was kind of a draw. So I would say, in the minds of people in the South, in the minds of the people in the Army of Northern Virginia, he's an icon. He's a rock star. Okay, this guy's a rock star. Well, there's a problem if you're a rock star, and that is, how can somebody come to you then, if you're a rock star, and say, you know, boss, I think this idea you've come up with is one of the dumbest ideas I've heard this week. Okay, that's pretty tough if you're an icon. You have to figure out how you get around that. On the other side of the field, of course, is George Gordon Meade. George Gordon Meade had been put in command of the Army of the Potomac, 3 days before the Battle of Gettysburg. On the 28th of June, a rider will show up at his tent. He was a corps commander. The guy will beat on the tent flap. Meade will wake up. The guy comes in, and Meade would write in his diary, "I thought I was going to be arrested." And the rider will say, "No, sir, it's worse than that. You're being promoted," because Abraham Lincoln had decided to accept which one you prefer, accept the resignation or fire the previous commander of the Army of the Potomac, a guy by the name of Joe Hooker, and place Meade in command now 3 days prior to this biggest battle ever fought on the North American continent. Well, that's put Sam in a pretty different position. Lee, the rock star, his guys will do pretty much whatever he tells them to do, and they believe if he thinks they can do it, they can do it. And you got Meade on the other side, and he's leading a bunch of guys, his principal subordinates, the corps commanders, all of them, several of them by date of rank actually outranked him, though he is in command, number one. Number two, I'm sure a lot of them thought they were a better general. They probably even thought they were better looking than Meade was, for that matter. But he's got to figure a way back that to that definition I mentioned a moment ago of Eisenhower, of deciding what has to be done and then getting others to want to do it, getting a consensus so we're as effective as we can be in meeting the challenge of the Confederate Army that has been so successful here in the Eastern Theater of War for the last couple of years.
Well, that's challenging. You know, if anyone in business has come into a new place, okay, whether they own the business, they took over a business perhaps, or they're in that, you know, that upper level of management and had to walk in to do this stuff, it's probably a very similar thing, right? You've got the people that are going, "Who's this clown?" Right? I mean, that's the first impression, you know, and you've got to, you know, that's a challenge. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, think about it. There's a new book out by a guy named Jeff Immelt, who was the past CEO of General Electric. Well, Jeff Immelt followed Jack Welch, and Jack Welch had been a wily, by some people's accounts, I'm not sure I totally agree, but many people point to Jack Welch as an outstanding example of a successful business leader. And if you looked at the value of General Electric stock during the time that Welch was the CEO, you'd have to say, if that's your measure of success, you know, they did pretty doggone well. That's a pretty tough act to follow. Emil comes in to take over from Welch when Welch steps down. His first day on the job as CEO of General Electric, September 11th, 2001. That was his first day as CEO, and GE stock dropped, I think it was $16 a share in one single day.
Wow. Yeah, there's commander in crisis, right?
Exactly.
That is it's a challenge. So, well, so as the battle progresses here, where are we at with Meade and Lee? So, I mean, kind of take us through this if you could.
Well, let me begin at the beginning. Let's start with the first day of the battle. It's a three-day battle, and there's interesting things along the way. The first day of the battle, what's interesting is George Meade's not there, and neither is Robert E. Lee. And so it's up to their subordinates and what direction, mission command, we call in the military, the general mission of the organization, they give out, and the initiative of people below them. And the reason the battle occurs at Gettysburg is really because of a Union cavalry commander by the name of John Buford, who will arrive on the 30th of June with his cavalry brigade. And he will occupy a ridge lines on the western side of the city. He quickly does an assessment. They learn the Confederates are to their west, number one. And number two, he assesses that the most important terrain is the terrain just to the east of the town, Little Round Top, Cemetery Ridge, Cemetery Hill. And so I'm going to put my guys two ridge lines westward, and hopefully I can trade space for time and hold the Confederates off. What's interesting about that from a leadership standpoint to me is he makes that assessment, makes an act, and takes action quickly. That's true. But number two, he sends a message to his boss, who's a three-star general, Buford being a one-star general. His name is John Reynolds. And he says to Reynolds, "The Confederates are here to my front. I've occupied just west of the town. Get the infantry up here first thing in the morning." So here's a subordinate telling the boss what to do. Well, Reynolds could have said, "Hey, why don't you come back here? We're going to have a committee meeting. We're going to study the problem. We're going to go through options and we'll figure out what we're going to do." No. These two guys had worked together, back to that issue of trust, you know, and decisions can move, action can move at the speed of trust. Reynolds trusts Buford. If Buford says we need to get the infantry there first thing in the morning, that's what I'm going to do. We're not wasting any more time. We're on our way. Okay. They have done that Vulcan mind meld. And what Buford is really doing is leading his boss, telling his boss what he needs to do. And a climate has been established in that organization where Reynolds was willing to accept that. And that's critical. You know, I always say smart people lead their boss consciously, less smart people lead their boss unconsciously, and smart bosses want to be led. If you're leading, if you're the captain of a ship, it doesn't do you any good if somebody walks up and says, hey, by the way, captain, we're 6 inches from an iceberg. That's interesting. It's just not terribly useful. You know, 6 miles from the iceberg. Ah, that's interesting and useful. And then secondarily, the battle will go on that day. Over time, the Confederates will be larger in number. They'll overwhelm the Union forces on the first day. They will flee through the town, and the Union forces then will occupy those ridge lines that Buford had thought were so critical, Cemetery Ridge, the Round Tops, Cemetery Hill. A subordinate Confederate to Robert E. Lee, a corps commander named Richard Ewell, will arrive. And as the Yankees late in the day are fleeing through the town, he'll receive a message from Robert E. Lee, who has arrived late in the afternoon. And in that message, Lee will say the following: pursue the enemy through the town and occupy the hills on the other side of the town if you deem it practical to do so, giving him an out. It's up to you. Make a choice. Make a call. Okay. Ewell had only been in command of that corps for about a month. He just got elevated from being a divisional commander, and he hesitates. He hesitates for a host of reasons, and he does not pursue. And as a consequence, the Union is able to dig in on Cemetery Ridge, Cemetery Hill. And this is one of the most critical decisions in American history. Many would argue that if Ewell had shown a certain amount of initiative and pursued vigorously, it would have been a one-day battle, a Confederate victory, and then you can spin your history any way you want to. But part of that was, I think, not only being in a climate that developed initiative. Ewell had worked for Stonewall Jackson. Jackson routinely court-martialed people for the violation of a smallest order. So he didn't develop people with a lot of initiative, number one. And number two, I think his boss, Robert E. Lee, as a leader, should have realized, and this is the same challenge leaders have today, I have elevated somebody to a position of much greater responsibility than they've had in the past. Therefore, I got to give them a bit more guidance until they get comfortable, they understand the job, they build up their confidence, and then over time, I can back off and give them broader guidance and allow them to execute, freeing me up to think about bigger thoughts for my organization. But I think in many ways, Lee had been very successful in this broad, you know, orders kind of business because he'd had very successful people like Jackson working for him. But Jackson's dead now. So I believe in many ways, and Robert E. Lee would send that message to Ewell saying, take that hill if you deem it practical to do so. He was writing that message to Jackson. He was not, because he was exercising the same style with a subordinate leader who was very experienced, and he was doing that the same way with a new leader who was perhaps not as confident, new in the job, and had never really been encouraged to show any initiative in any previous position he'd had.
So do you think Jackson would have taken the hill?
Absolutely, without question. Now, we can conjecture about that all you want to. Obviously, nobody knows. He was dead by then. He had been injured, wounded at Chancellorsville in a friendly fire incident. And he had died about a month before Gettysburg is fought. People have written history. Newt Gingrich, believe it or not, former congressman, actually wrote a book about Gettysburg in which he fantasizes that Jackson was there. Jackson pursued. Jackson took the town. And then we get into a whole different ending to the American Civil War in which the South is preserved as a country and becomes a separate nation. So that's how critical that one event might have transpired. Though, again, we're all playing in fantasy history when we talk about that.
Right. I love the big takeaway of that little exchange. It was really the experience, inexperience, and the trust factor, right? Yep. Really knowing your team, you know, knowing who's got the capabilities, who may have the potential, but they don't have the experience yet, right? So that's, and maybe that's where that was, you know. But again, I think you're right. Maybe being the rock star that Lee was, that he is, you know, he's kind of, I don't know if they get, you know, they're a little too much in the rear, you know, with the gear, and now they're forgetting, you know, the real leadership, you know, traits and the things you got to do and really honing in on what they are. Do you think maybe he was just kind of just that way, and he really was maybe just thinking one is the same as all, or how did that work out? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there are two things going on here. You know, nothing is successful like success. You know, there's an old saying or an old story back to ancient times, and that is when Roman conquerors would return from their latest exploits, and they would enter the city of Rome in a chariot, leading a parade of soldiers, leading a parade of wagons, of booty, leading a parade of prisoners of war who are now going to become slaves to the Roman Empire. So it's a great and glorious parade as they enter the city of Rome. They had a tradition in the Roman Empire, though, that when the general entered the city in his chariot, they put a slave in the chariot alongside him. And as he was receiving all this adulation from the crowd for his amazing successes, the slave would continuously whisper in his ear, "All glory is fleeting. All glory is fleeting." Just to remind him, you know, that just because you did really well this time doesn't mean this is always going to work out. And I think one of the challenges for Robert E. Lee is he has been very, very successful up to this point. And he's become convinced that his soldiers are almost invincible. He even talks about them in those terms. You might say he's been reading his headlines a little too closely, number one. Number two is his subordinate commanders are only four. One is the guy named Richard Ewell I just mentioned, brand new in command. Another guy is a guy named Ambrose Powell Hill, also newly positioned as a corps commander. Well, they're brand new in command. They're not going to walk up to the rock star and say, "Hey, boss, this is the dumbest idea we heard this week." Third guy is a guy named Jeb Stuart, who is his cavalry commander, been with him for a long period of time. But as the battle unfolds on the 1st of July, Jeb Stuart's not there. He's out gallivanting around on a raid, which I think he conducted, and we can talk about that if you want to, for his own glory more than for the success of the organization. So Stuart's not there. And the one person in this relationship is probably one of the key parts of the battle on the Confederate side, is a guy named Peter Longstreet, who'd been with Lee for a long period of time. Throughout this battle, at the end of the first day, as again, the Yankees are fleeing through the streets and are building up trench lines on Cemetery Hill, Longstreet and Lee will meet. And Longstreet advises Lee, "Hey, we've been successful today. This is great. What we need to do is break away, move around the southern end of the Union lines and head towards Washington, threaten Washington, pick a piece of terrain that we think is good for us, put our troops on that, and let the Yankees attack us. Let the Yankees attack us. That's what we need to do." And Robert E. Lee goes, "No, no, no. If those people," he always said the people, not the enemy, "if those people are there tomorrow, I'm going to attack them right there." And for the next 2 days, really, there will be this on again, off again argument between Longstreet and Lee. Longstreet saying, "We need to get out of here and go someplace else." Lee arguing, "We need to continue to attack," obviously underscored by Pickett's charge on the third day. So I think Lee was reading his headlines perhaps a little too closely. Secondly, and this back that issue of self-awareness we mentioned a moment ago, there's very good reason to believe that Robert E. Lee was not all that healthy during the Battle of Gettysburg. We know he was suffering from a bad back. Some think he had a sciatic nerve problem in his back. We know he suffered from what they used to call old soldier's disease or dysentery, because there's entries in Confederate soldier diaries about frequent back and forth by Lee from his headquarters to the privy all throughout the night. And last but not least, there's some evidence that Robert E. Lee might have suffered a mild heart attack during the battle. He will die from heart disease a few years after the war is over. So leaders have got to be very concerned and self-aware about themselves. How am I doing, particularly during a crisis? Because oftentimes a crisis, as I like to say, is a marathon. It's not the 100-yard dash, to ensure that I am physically, mentally, and emotionally in the best position to make very tough decisions when they have to be made.
Yeah, that is important. Let me ask you on that note too. Where is he at from the advisory role, right? So you know, the way I look at things, I'm always looking. I build my own little board of advisors, you know, whether directly related to me or they're just people I know outside who can bring a different set of eyes to my business. In the leadership role, you know, how critical is that you get these differing opinions? Like you said, you're not reading your own headlines all the time. You're not thinking that you're the smartest guy in the room all the time. Is that a critical element as well?
Absolutely. In fact, it's fascinating to use that phrase, smartest guys in the room. I commend to corporate groups when I'm doing this on the battlefield, there is actually a video called Smartest Guys in the Room. and smartest guys in the room is about the collapse of Enron, one of the largest corporations in the United States when it collapses back in 2007. And the leader of Enron was a guy named Ken Lay, who was indicted, was never convicted because he died of a heart attack before his trial came due. But there are many arguments, he would argue, and there's some evidence that he had created a climate, either consciously or unconsciously, that the only news that got to him was good news. You know, and we can do this. We as leaders, if we're not careful, you know, can create a climate where only good news gets to us. And because we all know, if, you know, the first time somebody comes in and tells us something that sounds bad, if we shoot the messenger, well, after a while, I got a flash for you. The only thing that's going to come in that door is going to be good news, because everybody learns the boss shoots the messenger every time bad news shows up. And that seemed to be what happened with Lay. So you've got to create a climate where, as somebody once said, you know, the ugly gets to me. You know, Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and I think a great leader, used to say, look, when I became an admiral, I realized two things were going to happen forever. One is I was going to eat well. And number two, nobody was going to tell me the total truth ever after. Okay. So I've got to really push hard to make sure that my immediate reports are telling me what's really going on. And I've got access to information that really is going to be, you know, critical when I make choice, because that's what organizations do. Every organization takes information and from that makes choice. And on the final day, to get back to that advisory thing one more time, on the final day of the battle, or the evening before, the 2nd of July, 1863, that evening, probably one of the most important evenings in the history of the nation, two meetings are conducted. One is at Robert E. Lee's headquarters on what are we going to do on the third day. And Lee doesn't call for any advice from anybody. He just consults himself and figures out what he's going to do and decides on this frontal assault known as Pickett's Charge. So he doesn't consult anybody. On the other side, about a mile and a half away from where Lee is a small house that the Union Army has appropriated for General Meade. Meade meets with all his subordinate commanders, a total of nine. Now, again, he's been in command now a total of 4 days. And as I said, many of these subordinates probably thought they were a lot smarter than he was. They discuss their options. Their options are three. We can stay and defend, we can attack the Confederates, or we can retreat. And they argue about that for a while. And finally, his chief of staff, a general by the name of Butterfield, suggests that they have a vote. And they take a vote in reverse order. The most junior guy votes first on which option, up to the most senior guy. They do that in that way to ensure the most junior guy is not influenced by someone who's senior to him by rank. And they decide to stay and defend Cemetery Ridge against what will be this attack known as Pickett's Charge. I firmly believe, by what I've read and studied of Meade, that that's what Meade was going to do anyway. They were going to stay and defend, but because he'd only been in command a short period of time, back to that advisory issue you mentioned, he felt a need to draw from his subordinates to try to build a little bit of consensus, since I haven't got absolute trust from all these people just yet, because I've only been in command a couple of days.
Yeah, well, that's actually pretty brilliant. You know, because, I mean, I guess the decision could have gone anywhere. I also love to start with the junior officer so that it's not influenced. That's critical. That's really great insight. You know, whoever thought of that at the time, I think it's that's actually, because a lot of people want to be those yes men. You know, if you're trying to come up that ladder, you know, that, you know, having that pushback could really slow your progress, right? So a lot of people are just kind of, well, they don't, I'll go along with them because they've been here a lot longer than I have. So that takes a little bit of courage. You know, really, really speak your mind at that time. And that's very fascinating that he actually, you know, and it's, to me, it's a way of doing battle in a sense. You got to check with your people on the field, right? That's where you want, but you want the live intel, right?
Exactly.
You know, who hasn't even been here yet, that's, and then he's taking his own advice and not taking those, you know, what's coming in from the field.
That's exactly right. You know, and really, you can contrast that even that way. There's two ways people make decisions. One is informed by drawing information, data, and the other is intuitive, the so-called gut, you know, gut feeling about things. Robert E. Lee has been making intuitive decisions and been successful, and that's basically what he does. And he doesn't even get information necessarily about casualty figures, how much ammunition we got, any of those basic things that I would think any military commander would like to know on that fateful evening. Meade is making informed decisions. Not only is he getting input from all his commanders on what they think we ought to do, he's also talking to them about, again, how's your casualty levels? How's your food level? How much ammo have you got? How's morale? How's morale? That's a very important subjective ingredient that we all know. So he's getting that information instead of being intuitive. Furthermore, this is where organizations adapt and organizations innovate. The Union Army had innovated in a very interesting way. And that is, along came a colonel by the name of Sharp. And Sharp would create for the Union leadership on the Army of the Potomac what we would call the first sort of intel cell. And what he brought together was a bunch of guys, and they would interview prisoners, and they would interview people who had seen movements, and they would read messages and whatever they could gain. And from all that raw intelligence, they would create a picture for the commander of what the enemy was up to. And by the end of the second day, he could pretty much lay down for Meade what the strength of the Confederates were and how they were kind of in place, using what we would call now very crude matrices. So Meade's making informed decisions based on the knowledge of his organization and based on a pretty good picture of his opponent in this competition. Lee is making intuitive decisions based on his gut and experience without really that degree of an analytical support about his adversary or really a lot of clear information from his organization.
Yeah, that's very, very polar opposite there. I'm gonna go with Meade, okay? But I mean, just from without even knowing the outcome, okay? If I didn't have to choose the outcome right now, I didn't know what it was gonna be. I mean, obviously, my approach is the same as Meade's, and I'm not saying that because you want. I mean, I just learned that over years, first from being in the Marine Corps, and then secondly, just being in business after that. It was just a continuation, basically. To not to reach out and not to grab all the intel you can, whether you're going for a new market share in the business, you're trying to grow the company, you're trying to survive. How you're gonna deal with the competition that's coming in, undercutting you, doing this, doing that. This is all intel that a business leader has to have, and then convey that to his people, get all the feedback, and then make the decisions on where to go. So it's a great comparison.
Yeah, but there's a danger there. I think it's important for us to bring up, Richard. And the danger is we live in an environment now, right now, I don't care what you're leading, you're just being bombarded by information, and you can come up with methods and have all kinds of data, okay? But you got to figure out two things. Which of this data is really important to the decision I'm about to take? And number two, when do I have enough data for me to make a decision? Colin Powell used to say, P equals 40 to 60. When you got about 40 to 60% of the information you'd like to have, it's time to make a call. It's time to pull the trigger. Because if you say, well, I'm going to wait till I got all the information I ever wanted, well, you and I both know you're never going to make a decision. And time is the most important resource that a leader has to manage. He or she manages that resource like any other, but we can throw more people at a problem, perhaps money at a problem, or capital items at a problem, but time is somewhat inelastic. And the more we defer making choice, we know that our options will start to shrink, or it'll be much more difficult for those below us to take our decision and translate it into action by what they do with their organization. I'm a big baseball fan. I'm a Chicago Cubs fan, actually. So 2016 was a great year for me when the Cubs win the World Series. The manager at the time was a guy named Joe Maddon, who's still a manager for the Los Angeles Angels. He was interviewed one time, and came up with what I thought was a fascinating way to look at the difference between leadership and management. And he said, in baseball, we now can measure everything. I can measure how fast the guy throws the ball, how fast the ball comes off the bat, how fast the guy can run, the probability of the guy catching the ball as soon as it's hit, how much the ball is spinning so I can rate the guy's curveball, all those things. I can do all that. But I can get buried in data. I got to figure out for a particular decision which of this data is most important for the decision I need right now. But then he said the second part of this, and this is more of a leadership item, is when I come to thinking about players I'm going to recruit or players I'm going to trade for or players I'm going to, order up in the draft, I want to know about their heartbeat. And that is subjective. I can measure this person's physical abilities, how fast they can run, how hard they can throw a ball. But I can't measure their heartbeat. I got to figure that one out. So I interview their girlfriend, their ex-girlfriend, their wife, their ex-wife, their college roommate. I want to talk to all these people because what I want to know is, despite the data of this person's ability, will their heartbeat fit on my team? Because they could have the greatest data going, but if the heartbeat doesn't fit on the team, they're not going to be successful with us and we're not going to be successful with them.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that distinction. It's very important to understand. I'm a big fan of imperfect action.
Exactly.
You know, too much planning. So I love the 40 to 60% data aspect. That's great because you should be able to make a competent decision with that kind of data coming in because you can get lost in it. You're totally right, Jeff. This is like, it's a very strong point because there, you have the access to every bit of information on the planet at your literally in your hand, literally with the phone. Right? So you got to know when is enough, right? And I really like that. That's an important distinction. Also about what you're saying with team members. You know, again, you can have, I use this comparison too, like whether it's a baseball coach, a football coach, you get a guy comes and everyone, you know, he comes to the Bears, let's say you're Chicago Cubs fan, so we'll use the Bears. So he goes to them and he's horrible, right? And everyone says he's the worst coach ever. They fire him after a year or two.
Right.
He goes to the next team and wins the Super Bowl next year.
Right.
And they're like, what? I go, it's the team. It's who he gels with, right? It's exactly what you're talking about. It's the heartbeat. You know, that's the difference. You know, and you can't put numbers on that. You can't, you know, there's no data that's going to show you that really, right?
Exactly. That's exactly correct. You know, Eisenhower, back to him, he used to say planning is everything, but the plan is really nothing. You know, planning is everything because the planning is the assessment of the environment, all the data input, all the options we may take, you know, courses, branches and sequels. We talk in the military, if this happens, we're going to do this. We thought this problem through. But the plan, you know, is still an outline. And as we used to say in combat, I think it applies in any organization, no plan survives the first round fired. And the perfect plan has never been executed because we're still trying to make it perfect, perfect. So we need to make sure that we make a decision. And I always like what I call the 20%, 80% solution, that 20% of the time that's available between now and when I went execution begin, that's my time as the leader to think through options and plan. And then I tell my people what I want done. And then 80% of the time is for them to then do their preparation so we can begin on time. If I wait till the last minute and come out with this enormously detailed plan, but they haven't had sufficient time to then explain it to their people, you know, marshal all the resources they might need. We may have a great plan, but our execution is going to be awful.
Yeah, there's so much that goes into stuff, you know, and you got to think about that. And time is a major, like you're saying, it's a major component. It's limited. There's only so much. You have to stretch it out. You can add more people. You can add more money, you know, but time is where it's at, you know, so that's awesome. I mean, that really is something that people need to consider in business, you know, is time factors, right? I mean, we get pressure.
Yes.
We get crisis. All that, but you've got to understand. We had talked before we jumped on the recording here about, you know, speed attracts money, one of my blogs and stuff. And it's true. There's a speed aspect of things, which comes back to time, you know, and it just means, you know, how fast can you deliver your product, right? How fast can you deliver an estimate? You know, how fast can you do anything in your business? You know, not to sacrifice quality, but there's an element of speed and condensing time that can lead to victory.
Yeah, and when you make a decision can be as important as the decision you take. We talk in the book about a concept called the OODA loop, OODA, observe, orient, decide, and act. That was created by a fighter pilot named John Boyd for training fighter pilots. In aerial combat, you observe the environment you're operating in, you orient on the key aspect of what's going on in that environment, you make decisions against that, and you act. And if you do that more quickly than your opponent, then your probability of success goes up significantly. And Boyd translated that to big organizations and spent his time after he left the Air Force as a consultant in major corporations, because the same thing applies. As a corporate leader, I look at the environment, I observe the environment I'm operating in. Right now, a very, very vague and uncertain environment based on the pandemic and economic uncertainty. I orient on what are the key things going on in this environment right now. I make decisions against that and I act. And if I can do that more quickly than in my competition, I have a greater chance for being successful. But the other part of that is, again, not only is time important, but we got to be able to adapt as we move along in our execution. Because in the business environment or the military environment, one has to remember that our opponent gets a vote on our plan. You know, we're not working against a static opponent in business. We're not working as a static opponent in combat. So you can come up with the greatest plan going, but your opponent gets to do something too. So you have to continue to adapt and react in that environment based on what your competition is doing. Because again, your opponent, the enemy, they get a vote on your plan.
Right. I mean, that's, wow, that's the way to look at it. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of elements to this, you know, what I love what you do, Jeff, your whole, you know, the Diamond Six leadership stuff. I mean, you have an unbelievable, I was telling you before, it's just, you have an unbelievable faculty. I mean, just, it's so impressive, the team that you've put together in this business as you're helping businesses, you know, just create great leaders, because it's always, always, always a complete, very top all the way down, any business, whether you're talking about company culture, you know, driving sales, everything comes from that top leadership. And I really try to express to people the importance of owning, right, your leadership, right, owning your real business, like it's right. you responsibility on this stuff. So let's take a quick minute and just kind of explain what that's about, really having that ownership of leadership, because I think that's a strong point I'd love you to bring up.
Glad to. Let me put a quick plug in. As you said, Diamond Six Leadership, we do these executive leadership workshops for corporations all across the country. Anybody can find more about that at www.diamondsixleadership.com. You have to spell out the six. I'm off next week, for example, to go to Indianapolis to run a three-day workshop for a big educational association for senior leaders all across the state of Indiana. That whole idea of responsibility, you know, and there's a difference between authority and responsibility. As we move up to higher and higher positions of responsibility in an organization, higher and higher positions in the organization, we have to give out authority to others because we can't do everything. It's not possible. But responsibility ultimately rests with us. And these two characters we've been talking about, Robert E. Lee and George Gordon Meade, sort of at the end of this battle, you might say, kind of react in very different ways. The attack on the 3rd of July by the Picketts, of course, begins about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's over in an hour. It fails. One out of every three guys who advanced from Seminary Ridge towards Cemetery Ridge on the Confederate side, one out of every three is dead, wounded, missing, or never seen again. 30%+ casualties in an hour. Okay. As the survivors are streaming back across the field, Lee is on a horse on Seminary Ridge towards the center of where the line was. And many of the soldiers came up to Lee and said, General Lee, let us reform our lines and we'll attack again and we'll take that ridge this time. And Lee says to them, no, this is all my fault. This is all my fault and you have to help me. Now, Lee could have blamed a number of people. As I mentioned early on, Stuart was out missing. Ewell didn't attack vigorously on the first day. Hill began this whole thing without good guidance. Longstreet, many argued, drug his feet for the last couple of days. Lee could have blamed any one of those guys in history, but from the time he leaves Gettysburg until he will die after the war, I have not found anything that suggests Robert E. Lee blamed anybody but himself. He took full responsibility. And he would write a letter after the battle is over to Jefferson Davis, and he will offer his resignation. I have failed in my mission, which was to defeat the Union Army and win the war. I hereby offer my resignation. Davis will reject that, saying, no, you're still the best commander. So he accepts responsibility. Let's go across the other side of the field. Meade, you know, on the 4th of July, coincidentally, on the 4th of July, the battle is over. The Union's been successful. They receive a message that the Union Army outside of Vicksburg has accepted the surrender of the Confederate garrison at Vicksburg, which was the last Confederate bastion on the Mississippi. So the Union now controls the entirety of the Mississippi, has split the Confederacy in half, and we've won at Gettysburg on this 4th of July, ironically enough, and Lee will begin his retreat back towards Virginia. In the aftermath, many people criticize Meade for not pursuing Lee very vigorously and perhaps crushing the army there, and a good chance perhaps that the war might have ended on the summer of 1863. And you know, it's sad Richard, because if you check casualties, almost to the person, half of all Americans who die in the Civil War die before the 4th of July, 1863. The other half die after the 4th of July, 1863. So a lot of dying will continue. There are some reasons why Meade didn't pursue. His army's pretty beat up. The weather turns horrible. But he is widely criticized. Historians do this to this day. He will send a message to Abraham Lincoln, his boss. And in that message, a telegram, he says, "Mr. President, I have successfully defended the nation from rebellion." I mean, he's feeling pretty good. I mean, I just went 15 rounds with the heavyweight champion of the world, and I came out on top. None of my predecessors ever did that. I'm feeling pretty good about this, and rightfully so, perhaps. Lincoln is despondent. And this is a true, I think, leadership lesson for leaders as well. Lincoln, as a strategic leader, reads that and writes a letter to Meade. The letter begins, "My dear general, you can't defend the nation because it's one nation. And you let Bobby Lee get away." Okay. You haven't figured out what success looks like here, you know. But then Lincoln writes that letter, folds it, sticks it in an envelope, puts it in his desk drawer, and goes about the rest of his day, goes upstairs for the evening, comes down the next morning, looks at the envelope again, and never sent it to Meade. Left it in the drawer. Never sent it, okay? Because he felt, I think, ultimately, that the responsibility rests with me. I put this guy in command 4 days before the battle. He was successful, albeit in a tactical way, and I need him. I need him for the now for the rest of this war.
Wow, that's fast. But you know, that I really like that, Jeff. That's something I didn't know. And that's, you know, again, Lincoln taking the ownership, you know, commander in chief, right? I mean, yeah, I guess he could have, you know, said something to him, but it kind of was done, right? So I mean, the point was, you know, I don't know what the point was really, but I mean, just taking that ownership from Lincoln's standpoint is pretty amazing. And it is interesting to see, because Lee's response, taking total ownership for it, you know, until the day he died. I love that too. You know, I mean, there's great things about that. And then Meade, you know, I can see it. Again, he's young, you know, he's relatively inexperienced. He takes us and then wins. And then now here we go. Let's puff it up. And, you know, he doesn't have the slave whisper in his ear. All glory is fleeting, right? He doesn't have that. So he's thinking, you know, it's the thing. But I do love Lincoln's that we are still one nation. You know, he understood the goal. That's critical. You know, that's really, really critical. Maybe that message wasn't conveyed enough to, you know, to his commanders and stuff. I don't know.
That could certainly be. But, you know, that brings up, you know, sort of the final, as we come to toward the end of our time, I think, the final sort of chapter of Gettysburg that I find truly fascinating. And that really is, the battle ends on the 4th of July. Retreat begins that evening by the Confederates. Militarily, that's it. But the rest of the story actually comes to the 19th of November, 1863. And that's when Abraham Lincoln will arrive. He actually comes the evening before, but that's the day he'll deliver the Gettysburg Address to dedicate this cemetery to the dead. It's a fascinating event because, of course, Lincoln is not the principal speaker. The principal speaker is a guy named Edward Everett, who is a renowned orator, actually a political opponent of Lincoln's, had run against Lincoln on the Union Party ticket as vice president in 1860. So in many ways, a political opponent. Everett, quite a resume, president of Harvard University. He'd been our ambassador to Great Britain and had a whole bunch of other big jobs throughout the United States in the 19th century. So Lincoln's not the most, he's not the principal speaker. In fact, he doesn't get his invitation to go until the 2nd of November, about 2 weeks prior. Everett got his in September, several months prior. And Lincoln is asked by Governor Curtin of the great state of Pennsylvania if you could make a few appropriate remarks. So when they make their way to the cemetery on that afternoon, Everett will speak for 2 hours. And when he concludes, Lincoln obviously will rise, come to the podium, and deliver the Gettysburg Address, which is 272 words in length. Probably the most famous speech in American history, one that has been made into monuments. It's the only speech I know of that's been made into a monument. But in that particular speech, back to what Lincoln is trying to do and describe the big picture, he uses that as an opportunity, I would argue, to convey a new vision for where the organization, in this case, the United States, is going. And he organizes his remarks in a fashion that any leader who's listening can use. Any leader can use the outline of the Gettysburg Address in talking to his team. How so? Well, in those 272 words, it begins with, where are we now? The middle part talks about, where have we been? Starts with, where have we been? Second part is, where are we now? Third part, where are we going? Where have we been 47 years ago? Do the math, takes you back to 1776, signing the Declaration of Independence. What's that say? We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. Lincoln believed that document, Declaration of Independence, was the foundation of the Republic, not necessarily the Constitution, because the Constitution did authorize really slavery. It doesn't talk about slavery, but talks about 3/5 of a human being being counted for representation, meaning slaves predominantly in the South. Where are we right now? Well, he says we're met on the great battlefield of this war, and it's right and proper we should be here to dedicate this cemetery. Where are we going? And he concludes the speech with those words, we are going to a new birth of freedom. What's he talking about? Well, up until that point, the mission of the war, what was this all about if you were in the North, was preserving the Union. That's what Lincoln will talk about in his first inaugural. Really, that's what the Emancipation Proclamation is all about. It's not about freeing the slaves. It's about preserving the Union, because it only ends slavery in the states under rebellion. If you were a slave in Maryland, you were a slave in Kentucky, you were a slave in Missouri or Delaware, doesn't do anything for you. And once those states are not under rebellion, one could argue that property should be returned to its owner. But using that phrase, new birth of freedom, what he is suggesting is now the mission is still preserving the Union, but also ending slavery. And these two things are now inextricably linked. So those 15,000, that's what the estimate of people who attended, walked into that particular cemetery, the mission was preserve the Union. When they left, it's preserve the Union and end the slave and end slavery. And Lincoln will continue that as a plank in the Republican platform for his reelection in 1864, despite the fact that many senior political leaders in the Republican Party tried to convince him not to do that, because they argued casting that big picture, you'll lose the election. And Lincoln insisted, no, we have to do this. Now is the time for this new strategic vision.
Oh, that's awesome. That is, man, what incredible insight on this, Jeff. I just love what you've done with the Battle of Gettysburg from a leadership standpoint. I mean, I think, as you say this often, I mean, it really does, it's still relevant today. You know, the whole aspect of it, you know, from a leadership standpoint, whether you're in business, leading a company, leading men on the battlefield, whatever the case, I think it's still very, very relevant. And I think my biggest takeaway from this whole discussion today is just, again, being at the top, leadership, there's so much to be developed from a leadership standpoint. You know, you may get put into a leadership position, and maybe you can do it. Maybe you got a lot to learn, but just the beauty of it is there's a lot to be taught. And I love that's what your organization does. The Diamond Six does just that. So real quick, tell us how people can follow you. I know you mentioned the newsletter. I'm getting that now, which I love. But tell us how they can follow you. I know you guys do tons of speaking, tons of workshops, everything else. I'll put everything in the show notes so they have links for all this stuff too if they want to go to it. But I just want to highly recommend that you get this out there, and for everyone listening, is to take a look at what you guys are doing, because it's really amazing from the leadership aspect. I love it.
Well, thanks very, very much, Richard. You're too kind. Well, the book again is Battle Tested: Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. That's available on Amazon, available at Barnes & Noble, available at a large number of bookstores. You can certainly contact us and see more about Diamond Six at www.diamondsixleadership.com. And you have to spell out the six, so it's all one continuous Diamond Six leadership word, if you will. Or you can email me directly at info@diamondsixleadership.com. I'd be delighted to correspond with you. Or talk to you about what we do with the company in terms of delivering executive leadership workshops for corporations all across the country. You know, we've branched out beyond Gettysburg, Richard, over the last decade that we've been doing this. And so we also do leadership workshops using not only Gettysburg as a case study, but Antietam and Bull Run in the Washington metropolitan area. We also do a leadership workshop down in Williamsburg using Colonial Williamsburg and the Battle of Yorktown, which is a fascinating experience. And we do a leadership workshop using the attack on Pearl Harbor as a case study for leadership, which I've done frequently both in Honolulu Or we can do that particular workshop almost anywhere, as well as Gettysburg, by using video. And that's what I'll be doing next week, is doing the case study from Pearl Harbor for this educational group out there in Indianapolis. If you decide to purchase the book, and you do so, and you send me an email to one of those addresses, I will also be happy to mail you free of charge a autographed book plate from both Tom Vossler, my co-author, and I, and you can place that inside the book.
Oh, that's fantastic. And yeah, let me just reiterate, you actually do these on site. So you're talking Gettysburg, you're walking them through, right? So a lot of the stuff is where these battles actually happen. You're doing these comparisons, right?
Yeah, we do it on site, but obviously you got to do a certain economies. I find it'd be more impactful and more meaningful to talk about leadership when you're standing on the field at Gettysburg and you talk about team cohesion. What did it take the Confederates to attack there on the third day to hold that team together? What does it take to build cohesion in a team? If you're standing there on the ground, it has a certain greater resonance, I think, with human beings. If you're talking about being part of a team and you're standing on the deck of the Arizona out there at Pearl Harbor, and you talk about what it meant to be a member of a team, obviously that has enormous resonance. If the hair on the back of your neck doesn't go up a little bit, I think we need to check your pulse and just see how you're doing. So those are obviously the most impactful in many ways. Or if you're standing in strategic or standing in surrender field at Yorktown, talking about how conflict resolution, how do you resolve conflicts in organizations, it's a pretty impactful place. That being said, sometimes economies don't allow that. And so we've constructed for Gettysburg and for Pearl Harbor an ability to do that anywhere in any conference room that you've got across the country. We can deliver that for a group using video that takes the person as best we can to the field at Gettysburg, to the deck of the Arizona and Pearl Harbor, as we use those as metaphors to talk about those enduring principles and concepts of leadership.
That's fantastic. I mean, I love what you've done with your business. I mean, to turn this into what you have, I'm just super impressed.
You have to come out, Richard, and I'll take you to Gettysburg.
I love it. We'll make a road trip with the family. My kids.
There you go.
You know, this will be a good time. I'm just so impressed by what you've done, and keep doing what you're doing. People need this level of experience and education. I mean, it's really lacking out there, and we could spend another hour talking about that, but we're not gonna, because you got things to do. I got things to do. But this has been just magnificent, man. Jeff, I appreciate the time today. Just cutting out of your schedule to be here with my listeners. And I can't thank you enough.
Well, great pleasure, Richard. And thank you so much for honoring us by being part of your podcast. And we can do another podcast sometime and talk about those things that we weren't able to talk about today.
I would love that. I could do this forever, man. I just love it. So thanks again, Jeff.
Thanks a lot, Richard.
Thank you for listening to the ETOP podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you liked what you've heard, please leave a great review for us. Your subscription and review helps us reach more people so we can show them how to escape the owner prison. Also, check out the links in the show notes about today's guests and more ways to connect with ETOP on social media. Stay strong and keep moving forward with your business.